The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of The Disciplined Investor Podcast. The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager.
Hello and welcome. Episode number 48 for The Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Horowitz, and we are going to be talking about all sorts of horrible, disgusting, foul, despicable things that have happened in the market because it was a week to forget very easily. It was one of those times that, I just want to say, what is going on? It feels like I've been lied to. It feels like there's somebody just pulling the strings that really is, not doing it in my best interest or yours. And how do we get to the bottom of this? Hopefully, you've been reading the blog. We have a few things that we had posted in the blog on Tuesday and Wednesday that they were very, very timely, but yet at the same time, kind of lucky because what had happened by the end of the week when Bear Stearns collapsed and created just outright panic because of their insolvency. And do you really think that this was just all of a sudden? I mean, just way out of, we're going to throw in the towel. Well, how about the fact that the Fed really, they were setting up for this with their credit swap arrangement. We'll talk about that in a minute. Anyway, we have a lot of things coming up. That's great. We have Bill Carr that's coming up in an upcoming podcast. Mike Huckman, who is a CNBC healthcare and health specialist and biotech reporter. In the next podcast, Robert Reich, the former Treasury Secretary. And today we're going to introduce a new segment to the show, which is called The Zach Zone. And The Zach Zone is with portfolio manager Zach Seit, and he is going to be talking to us about IPOs and new issues. And we also have with us David Gaffin from The Wall Street Journal. He writes the Market Beat column as well as columnist for The Wall Street Journal. A great guy, writes great, great columns and really pays attention and knows his stuff. And we're going to talk with Harry Dent, the demographic economist that you all love. And I receive a lot of letters from you oftentimes asking about what is his prediction, what is he saying. So we'll talk about that at length with them today. And then we have a couple of questions we're going to answer from you that were sent in from the last show that were left off of last week's. That was a great, great, I thought it was a great discussion. Got so many emails in from people that said thank you. That was a lot of help, and for you helping out, I had a few we couldn't fit on, of course, so I answered them separately, and thank you for those. I did want to mention to you that we are going to get to that. I also wanted to share with you something I think is important. If you haven't spent some time on the blog, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, I know it's easy to listen here, and I understand that it's portable, and you can listen to me talking about these various topics, and I've talked to a lot of you offline. And you had mentioned to me about, asked me questions about things. There is so much that I write about on a day-to-day basis on the blog. I wrote about Bernanke's magic hat, explaining some things I'll get to in a minute. I talked about his junk exchange, and I talked about screening process from the chapter on quantitative investing in my book, The Disciplined Investor. I brought you a screen that was very protective of capital. As a matter of fact, since we brought it out on February 14th, through now, which is about the middle part of March, we have found that it's up 1% while the markets are down about 3-4% in that same period of time. So we're going to talk about some of the things that were on the blog and some of the things I've been writing about, some things about Bear Stearns and what's going on.
Hi, this is Grammar Girl from QuickAndDirtyTips.com, and you're listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Hi, and welcome back to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. It's Andrew Horowitz, and what I want to talk about for a moment is this whole discussion about what has happened in the markets, and we saw that incredible $200 billion bailout package. It was really far from that, actually. It was more like a quick, here's what happened. It was called, as I say, a credit swap. So let's say that you have a 1970 car, and it's running like real crap, okay? And I say to you, I got an idea. How about I give you a brand new Rolls Royce and you give me your 1970s junker and you're going to be in great shape. And I'll do that for you because you need to get to work. You need to do your things. You need to make sure things are working. And I don't really care because I have plenty of Rolls Royces. Don't worry about it. Essentially, that's what the government did. They basically gave good paper in replacement and in exchange for real crap that was going under because of the subprime and non-performing loans and illiquidity issues of the notes and loans and the paper that was outstanding from certain companies. And the question you have to ask yourself is, how long can that really go on? When you look at Ben Bernanke, I think that the academic Ben has shown really a good amount of magic. And he reached deep inside, and we saw that this giant hat forming of miracles that he was putting his hand in and pulling out, from traditional rate cuts to tapping the lesser-known discount rate window and all the way back again. And he really has been wrangling with a problem of just how to get some breathing space between today and an eventual foreclosure of the good old U.S. of A. It really is an effort of global proportions. The latest move to avert an all-out economic nosedive was really a global phenomenon, bringing everybody together. And I wonder what is going to happen next. And that's why when we wrote about this in the last number of days and we talked about how there were some great opportunities that you could utilize and invest on the short side, I think that you really had to pay some attention to some of the inferences that you could find out there. It's not easy. And I think when this really comes out in the future and we really investigate what's happened, we'll realize that there's a lot of things that were hidden from us. Nonetheless, I think that when you are looking at bulletin boards like the Yahoo boards we printed, where it says, quote on the boards, I'm hearing HSBC CDs desk is refusing to quote Lehman and Bear Stearns and Goldman Sachs CDs. In other words, they were not allowing their desk to look at the investments of the companies that would be backed by those companies, the CDs, the commercial paper, etc. And what I told people that were listening and watching in the blog was that you need to take some time to cover and hedge up the portfolio. Look at the quote SDS and SKF and QID, the short financials, the short NASDAQ, et cetera, as short ideas, because don't be surprised that over the next few days when you hear an all-out concern and crying, because we're going to hear horrible news and rumors all leading to the failure of a brokerage or bank. That's what I said on Wednesday. If you were reading the blog, and I hope you do from now on, please go to the blog, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and take a read of it and bookmark it or subscribe. It is an RSS subscribe. So with that, I think that, you know, again, we've been talking about this for months, and I know you've been paying attention. A lot of you have thanked me. If it's now, it's still not too late to make sure you have the right things inside of your portfolio. Let's get to a couple of questions, or some answers, I should say. One in particular I want to talk about is about this whole issue of tax lien certificates. Let's take a listen.
Hi, I have a question for your next show. I live in Las Vegas, Nevada, and of course Nevada is the number one market for foreclosures, of course, in the entire country. And somebody mentioned to me that you can actually buy these homes at auction through a tax lien or through a property tax lien. I kind of wondered, how does that work, and is that really a viable investment? Would love to hear your opinions on it and see if this is a good way to play the foreclosure market. Thanks.
All right. Now, that's a great question, tax lien certificates. A lot of them out there because a lot of people are maybe foreclosing, and there's a lot of problems with their properties right now. And I went to a variety of places because this is not my expertise area, because we really deal with more of a traditional portfolio. I manage, $70 million of assets for clients on a regular basis. But tax lien certificates, here's the bottom line on there. There are some risks involved in these. These are when you are actually going to get collateralized housing. In other words, so you have a foreclosed house, maybe because or a house that they still own, but there is a tax lien on it for some reason. It could be for a lot of reasons. They didn't pay for the taxes. There was some type of situation that was involved in maybe a criminal activity, et cetera. And you oftentimes will have a great small a benefit because you have a small amount of money you put down on this investment. You buy these tax liens and you get maybe the collateralized of the house behind it. So what happens is that you may be able to get a great return on your investment, but the risks involved in it are very significant. Because what happens if maybe the house that you have involved with is going to be maybe totally taken back due to a drug and criminal action, and what will happen is that you will lose that because it was a fraudulent transaction, if you will. And there's some question as to the proper titling and bankruptcy issues with the owners and the people, and I just... You know, there's all sorts of things that may be a little questionable. It is a great investment. They're showing 15, 20, 30, 50% returns. Just be very careful if you're going to use these as an investment idea. In fact, I do think that that these are a good place to put some money, but don't listen. There is no free lunches, guys. We know that, right? We know that there's nobody getting nothing for nothing. So make sure that you follow the rules. Make sure you go to your state and utilize it from there. Don't buy it on secondary brokers. If you're going to learn about this, my friend, if you're going to utilize this, be careful. In Vegas, with the high level of foreclosures and bankruptcies and concerns there, only third, I think, to probably to California and Florida, be very careful and understand what your rights are in the event of full bankruptcy, and understand and do the research of who owned this and why this lien is outstanding on the house. Okay? All right. So what else do we have to say? Okay. Hey, by the way, my birthday's coming up on Thursday. If you're listening to this before that, March 20th, my birthday, and I'm in the mid-40s here. And but I want to do you do me a favor. Join me on my birthday, Tim Sykes and I, Daring versus Discipline. You know, Tim, in uncertain times like these, a disciplined approach to investing will really take you to where you want to be.
Andrew, hold up. I don't want to hear the word investing, okay? You need to be daring. You need to be a trader. I love penny stocks. Penny stocks?
Wait a minute. Are you kidding? That may be good for you, but I don't think, Tim, that it's really good for the masses. I don't think that most people can handle it.
Andrew, it's good for everybody, okay? I turned $12,000 into $2 million strictly on penny stocks. I'm going to do it again.
Oh, here we go again.
I love it, okay? I love this stuff.
Daring meets discipline. An interactive discussion with the disciplined Andrew Horowitz and the daring Timothy Sykes. Professional investors, authors, and as opposite as they come. Join in as Zecco brings you front and center. March 20th, 2008 at 5 p.m. Eastern. Day trading, buy and hold, and everything in between.
All right, Tim, so I'll give you, there is a place for that. Yet it seems that for most people out there.
Most, okay? I can't go along with whatever you say. If you like vanilla, I like strawberry.
Fine, strawberry, chocolate. I really don't care. Take your pick. Have a banana.
Mark your calendars. March 20th, 2008 at 5 p.m. Live on Zecco.com and Blog Talk Radio. For more information and registration, click on over to Zecco.com.
You can't get that with investing. I don't care.
Why do most people, do you think, why the action? We're going to be talking about investing that makes sense and maybe some that doesn't. Duke it out. We go head-to-head, Tim Sykes and I.
And that's brought to you by Zecco and Blog Talk Radio.
All right, as promised, we have a great lineup today. We have David Gaffin from the Wall Street Journal and Harry Dent, an economist who does a lot of work in the area of demographic economics. So let's just start right in with all the things that are going on. Harry, you know, explain just quickly, what is the prediction that you have, that you've had in terms of the markets moving forward into 2009, 2010?
Well, we've been saying for two decades now, since the late 80s, that based on baby boom spending, you know, very quantifiable demographic trends that we can measure and project in the future, that this great boom we've been in since the early 80s would finally slow down around the end of this decade. Not the end of last decade when we had the tech wreck, but the end of this decade. And so we've been looking for a more serious slowdown and downturn, a stock crash, another bubble burst, and the final deflation of the housing crisis, which has already started, and a bubble that's yet to burst, the commodity bubble, to all kind of start to unwind more seriously between mid to late 2009 and 2010 and 11.
Right.
So we're starting, obviously, to see some of that now.
So do you think that a lot of the things that we're seeing right now is either an advancement of this, or is this kind of not even anything to do with it, and we're really going to see something very much more significant maybe two years out?
Yeah, no, it really is. We're getting a peek at what's going to happen. A lot of people think, and I think this is going to be a big mistake by the Federal Reserve, which would cost Bernanke his job, by the way, is that they're assuming, okay, this is a temporary crisis because of this housing slowdown. It's kind of like the early 90s when housing slowed down, just a little worse and a little more leverage. And so if we can just back up the system here and keep things together for the next year or so, we'll come out of it and we'll be okay long term. Mm-hmm. And what we're saying is, yeah, this is the beginning of a long-term downturn. It is starting because baby boomers peaked in their housing purchases about 5 years before their overall spending.
Right.
And this slowdown has started to hit the banking system, which was extremely leveraged. And, you know, we know what happened in the last decade. People lent money to anybody, no job, income, anything. Didn't matter. Houses were going up. So this is the beginning of the end. That the three big bubbles, commodities, real estate, and stocks, will unwind to a greater degree over the next several years, and this credit bubble that has financed this whole thing is going to unwind, and it's already cracking. So again, this is the beginning, but this is happening before the demographic trends really weaken, and that's going to happen more, say, after 2009. So we're saying this is the beginning. It's going to get much more serious when the trends behind this long boom weaken.
Well, I feel much better. David, tell me something. You know, you have your you do a great job at collecting just a tremendous amount of data. You're a writer, but you also collect data from blogs and bring it on the online version in your market piece every day and out throughout the day. What is your sense of this whole thing with what's going on with Bear and the markets and the banks and the housing and all that?
Well, I hope you didn't get me on here to be the voice of sunshine compared to Harry, because I'm not sure I'm going to be able to do that.
Okay.
I think that Harry makes some good points about, where the economy may be headed. And I, think that regardless of, some of the demographics, the issue primarily revolved around easy credit for a long time. And when you take that away, as we've seen has happened, it's just caused enough of a cutting off of that which led to years of mortgage equity withdrawals and people essentially living on the idea that their houses would continue to go up in value, and we're discovering that that doesn't always happen. It it happens a lot of the time, but it doesn't happen all the time. And until that bottom is found, until housing prices are not falling anymore, that's how long I think this will take to really work itself out.
Right.
And The Federal Reserve is clearly doing a lot of things that are creative, that's for sure. I mean, they're not just sitting there and cutting the interest rates, and that's all they're doing. They've tried a number of things. They've got a number of tricks up their sleeve. And I think that they're doing a good job in at least trying to address these issues as targeted as they possibly can. Whether it will turn out to be the right thing or the wrong thing, we'll have to see. But
I think
the question is going to come down to whether they're just buying time for something that will work itself out, or this is something that needs much, much longer to take, and some of these efforts will end up being, somewhat futile, at least for those who, can't afford their mortgages or financial firms that are in the shape that we saw Bear Stearns is in.
Right. Well, I keep on saying to people, don't worry about any of this, because the truth is we'll probably run out of food long before anyway. So,
or energy or something else, yeah.
But one of the big issues that I've kind of been contemplating and really concerns me, and I've been doing a lot of writing lately because it's just been kind of a way to get it out of my system. A lot of things that I've been, I'm a money manager, but I implement many things I talk about. But today, with the, I'll tell you a quick story. My grandfather, who's about, he's about 90 now. I was talking to him yesterday. He says, "Yeah, can you believe it? They're buying Bear Stearns for $2, and the Fed is reducing rates by 25 basis points." I said, "Uh-oh, it's Sunday night. Finally, he's cracked." I said, he's unbelievable. He must be thinking back to a time, when he was a young boy and something, and then lo and behold, we have this situation. But I think that, and then we saw this massive sell-off in some of the areas today that were just unrelenting. And quite frankly, I felt ridiculous. But still, at the same time, why is it? And either of you could jump in here. What is with this commodity situation here? I mean, I know there's some supply issues here, but are we seeing a commodity bubble that people are just going after because there's nothing left that they could invest in on the stock market?
Well, I mean, I'll start with it, because our whole characterization of this boom in the last several years has been, look, it's not a bubble here or a bubble there. We're in a bubble boom. I mean, we had a bubble in oil prices in the peak in 1980. Then we had a bubble in the stock market in 1987 that crashed unexpectedly, extremely. And then, of course, a bigger bubble in stocks in the early 2000s that crashed. And as soon as that crashed, the money went straight into housing because it had nowhere to go. All these baby boomers and all their investment funds and all these leveraged funds and hedge funds. And now that housing is cooled down and other real estate areas are following, of course, it's all going into commodities and it's going to emerging markets, third world. So that's where the bubbles are now. So the thing is, these bubbles continue to build one after the next and burst, and the money flows into the next bubble until the whole bubble boom unwinds. What we're saying that is different, because we agree with David, a lot of people, I mean, yes, this is a credit bubble that's unprecedented in history, and it's got to deflate, and it's not sustainable, and finally the system's cracking, and then the everyday consumer's cracking under it. But the whole thing driving this train, including productivity, lower interest rates, higher earning and spending, and productivity, has been the rising baby boom generation, the largest in history. And they, like the Japanese in the late 80s, early 90s, yeah. are going to run out of spending power and simply age, and that's going to pull the blanket out of the whole thing. And that's why I would say, David, saying, what's the answer is this sustainable, what the Fed's doing? And I'd say, no, they cannot stop this. A bigger slide is coming.
Yeah, Dave, what do you think about that? I mean, what is your
keep going. I'm sorry.
No, I just want to know. You know, you've been writing. I track your stuff. I mean, obviously on the Wall Street Journal on what he writes, obviously, for the Market Beat. And, you know, everybody's blogging and talking and who's next and, you know, a great article and who else is flirting with disaster. I mean, but the bigger picture, let's talk about the bigger picture. In the bigger picture, in your opinion, who's flirting with disaster? I don't mean bank by bank. I mean, what's the big issue here globally?
I mean, the global issue seems to be one of, you know, I mean, there's a couple of things. The one is the solvency issue that continues to come up among the banks here. And then you have sort of the overall global demand issue. I guess the way I think of it, and I'm not sure if this is what's going to pan out, but I wonder if America hasn't seen its, you know, peak, at least in terms of its economic power. And mm-hmm. and I'm not, you know, saying that, you know, we're all, you know, headed to nothingness or what have you, but you see other regions of the world that are gaining a certain amount of, you know, power by the fact that they have so much demand, by the fact that some of them are in a bit of an industrial age, let's just say, and their demand for oil and for basic materials continues to rise. And that's fueling these gains in commodity prices. I mean, you can say that this is indeed a bubble, but Saudi Arabia and the rest of the oil-producing nations are producing they're pumping about all the oil they can right now. And, you know, this is as we're going into or in a recession. So that tells you that there is demand from somewhere. So that is not something that I think is going to just sort of dissipate. I think that those are long-term trends that are in place that are continuing.
But until we can't afford the cars anymore, right?
Right.
That's the big problem.
Well, that's the incremental. It is true that in demographics, we can show this just as much as anywhere in the United States, that there is rising demand for more consumers in more countries that are developing. And those demands are not, David's right, they're not going to slow down anytime soon, except for temporarily in reaction to what's happening in the global economy. But the difference is, we're still, the United States, the Western world, Europe, broader Europe, Australia, New Zealand, we are still like 60-some percent of the global economy. We're still the great majority of demand for oil, even though these other sectors are growing faster, and they are, and will be bigger. Our slowdown will take off pressures on commodity prices, and even if I didn't know that, we track everything on cycles, generational cycles, and this spending run about every 40 years. Commodity cycles peak like a clock every 29 to 30 years, and we're due between 2009 and 2010 for the next major peak, just like 1980, just like 1920 and 51.
Yeah, but the only thing is, you know, I wrote an article, and I was kind of in tongue-in-cheek. It was a little while ago. I called it 52 billion chickens, you know, with the idea that China, I see China as this giant Pac-Man. You know, Pac-Man, Wonka, yeah. Wonka, Wonka, right? And they're just like eating through the Earth's mantle. You know, and everything in their way. And I said, you know, how many, what, have you got a billion and a half, 2 billion, round number, you know, Chinese people in China, and they're eating, I don't know, a chicken a week. And you just do a rough calculation. You start getting into like the 50 billion chickens a year count. And I'm trying to, you know, put my hands around this and think, what does that look like? I mean, what is that? And sure. It really concerns me. I mean, David, I mean, the fact is that, you know, even though we have all this going on, it seems like we still can't get ourselves, you know, with all the demand and all that, we outsourced, didn't we? We screwed ourselves.
Well, I don't know. I think the point I was going to make when you mentioned this whole thing that you brought up with, you know, the demand from China, the chicken part of it, was actually just more of the issue with, you know, grains prices and agricultural prices that we're seeing, is because we're seeing a lot of areas where these prices are being made into energy markets. And so you're altering essentially the supply and demand, you know, an engine or some other type of, you know, motor is going to consume a lot more grain mm-hmm. than, you know, a person is.
Right.
And that's a lot of what's happening in those areas.
Yeah, corn with ethanol being a classic yeah. example. Right, exactly.
Absolutely. But, right. you know, I don't know what it is. I mean, our economy has been built a certain way, and now it's, you know, being challenged by other economies that are doing more with, you know, their cheap labor, which is something that we were able to do, but that was 150 years ago.
Well, I mean, I guess it's also, it makes a lot of sense when we talk about the potential for outsourcing, that some of the banking issues here and all that, if you think about it for a moment, if there isn't the mass, and I guess, you know, actually, let me just skip over Detroit being a microcosm of this, right? You know, and really, I mean, it's terrible. I was with somebody last night at dinner that lives in Detroit. I mean, they're telling me stories. It's horrible.
Yeah.
And you know, if you think about that, Is that really what road we're heading down? Because we just don't have the labor here. We don't manufacture here. We've let everything go. And I don't know. That's another scary thing.
That's probably another ball of wax in some way. But exactly. At the same time, you bring it up. What was our choice here? I mean, it's either a protective kind of measures that would keep manufacturing here that ultimately wouldn't be competitive globally, or to do some of what we've been doing, and then you involve yourself with a lot of retraining and things of that type, and maybe that's something that is easier for, let's say, a smaller nation to deal with, such as the United Kingdom, for instance. But I really don't know, because I'm not a student of that part of this kind of thing. But, you know, it seems to be a bit of a catch-22 here.
Right.
You know, it is a catch-22, though, because not every great nation, every great economic trend or regional trend has peaked at some time. I mean, you can only get so good before other people come from under you and compete at lower prices, and they're having more babies and growing faster. I mean, one of the paradoxes we show throughout history and demographics is that the richer and more urbanized a nation gets, the fewer kids it has, and that alone sows the seeds of death, because you don't have young people both to innovate and then earn and spend and buy homes and sustain your economy, and you have to rely on outsourcing. You have to rely on immigrants and or trade with other countries, and you're going to slow down eventually just because you're an older nation. Japan is the best example we give, mm-hmm. because in the 1990s, and we did predict this in the late 80s, that Japan was going to slow down for 12 to 14 years due to demographic forces. And, of course, they had a bubble in their stock market and real estate, but the real thing that killed it was the slowdown in demographic. Japan slowed down. Their stock market went down 80%. Home prices went down 60% in the 90s and early 2000s, while the rest of the world had the greatest boom in history because of their own internal demographics. Mm-hmm. So Japan is just showing what's going to happen to the rest of the Western
world. Is that what we're facing here, Harry?
That's what we're facing. Demographics is totally clear.
Do you think on that kind of magnitude?
Yes.
You do.
We've been saying this for two decades, that we're going to enter a depression in this next decade. It's not going to be as severe as the 1930s, but it's going to hit the Western world. People have been talking forever about things moving towards the East. Truth is, while East has been growing in Asia, we've been continuing to grow with all our lead in technology, but we're going to lose that lead as we age. And the same thing happened in Japan. And even if people argue to me, well, Asia's going to keep booming. And I say, you're right. But look at Japan. Their major investment markets went down. They had to deflate all these bubbles, even though the rest of the world was booming.
And well, the biggest issue also
this is going to be a much bigger downturn.
Yeah, but
it's not just going to be Japan. It's going to be the United States and all of Europe.
And what's interesting is, if again, the demographic part of it is what I always find fascinating. I'm just cuckoo about the demographic overlays that Harry's done when it comes to the people who are in that particular sweet spot age of what exactly is it, 45 to 54? 45 to 54, Harry?
Yeah, the peak spending is in the late 40s, 46 right. to 50 in the United States and most developed countries today. So once the bulk of a generation, and the Japanese were just 20 years ahead of us because they didn't have a baby boom after World War II for all types of reasons, but once a generation gets past that, like Japan did in the 90s, you can lower interest rates to zero, and that's what Japan did. And these older people won't spend money because they don't need anything. They're not raising kids. They're not buying houses. Their automobile now lasts 20 years because they drive it 3,000 miles a year because they're not taking the kids to soccer practice and they're too slow anyway. You know, Things just slow down and these people save instead of spend, and that kills your economy. And it kills the banking system because they lent all the money, all this stuff, and now there's a slowdown. And if assets deflate, mm-hmm. then the banks are stuck with loans that aren't so good.
I think there were some issues, though, with Japan in terms of how it handled its banking situation, handled its, specific economic problems. And while there are broader things you can say about, you know, every nation that, you know, goes through some sort of peak is going to end up in a decline, it doesn't have to be necessarily a fait accompli, or it doesn't have to unfold in the same way Japan will. That's not to say that, you know, we're not on some certain paths that are definitely, you know, troublesome with the amount of, particularly amount of debt that, you know, individuals have in this country. But this is not a predetermined course, and I'm sure you're not suggesting that either.
Well, the only thing is, can I just throw, we only have a couple minutes to wrap up. Everybody has a short amount of time today, but I want to ask one thing and throw this right in the middle of this discussion with it, what you both of you are just saying. Add the dollar to this discussion and the weakness and the fact that the Fed, in my opinion, is against a wall. I mean, you know, the reason why he has to be so creative, and or they have to be so creative, aside from the fact it does seem like they need a global a global power, global economic force to really help bail us out at this point, is that you can't really suggest that we could take the dollar down much lower, because then we have all sorts of other problems. I mean, yes, we get exports work and all that, but then how does that work with all this?
Well, frankly, real quickly, the Fed's in a mess. That's why I think Bernanke's out of here in 2009 or 10 at the latest. Because by stimulating the economy here, they are hurting the dollar. They're lowering interest rates here versus the rest of the world and creating, you know, outflows. And by stimulating the economy, we still have strong inflation pressures, which we can track the demographics as well. And they're going to come back in 2009 when we recover from this, and we're going to see inflation come right back. So they're going to look like they overdid this, even though right now it looks like they're doing the right thing. And it's not their fault. They are just in a mess.
No, I agree.
They're in
David?
A box. I agree with that part. They're in a box, and people are starting to talk more about the idea of the double-dip kind of recession coming back that would be fed essentially by, you know, you have all of these rate cuts, economy comes back a little bit, maybe the stimulus package comes in, and that helps it too a little bit. And then because of the inflation pressures that Harry's mentioning, which are out there, which are true, you know, even if, you know, the data undercounts it, you know, people can see it, then that, what happens then is that the Fed is forced into then raising rates to try to combat this, and that again hurts the economy heading into 2009. So you have a brief, you know, blip upward in the second half of this year, which is, I think, you know, becoming sort of the consensus, which means it's probably completely wrong.
But, you know, Andrew, real quick, our biggest surprise in the few years ahead is that, yes, the economy will recover from this. There will be inflation, like David's saying. That will wreck the party, along with commodities still bubbling up to more extremes. And the surprise of the next decade will be that inflation will suddenly turn to deflation in the early years of the next decade. Economists are going to start talking about stagflation, and inflation is the enemy. Once the economy slows down and we get this deflation of the bubbles, bubbles only end in deflation.
All right, quick, for both of you, we're gonna run, but from both of you, one question. What is the most overvalued commodity right now? What is the first one that's going to bust? David?
Oh, geez. I would wonder if it's one of the grains commodities, so along the lines of wheat or something like that. Mm-hmm. If supplies come back in, it just drops like a stone.
Yeah, we're not going to allow for a piece of inflation for long. Right? Harry?
Yeah, you know, the agricultures are probably getting the most overvalued, but really I think the one that's going to hit the news is oil's going to go to extremes way over $100 by late 2009, early 2010, and then it's going to crash to well below 40 or 50 and maybe ultimately as low as 10. That's going to be the one that people are going to see, because wheat doesn't affect people that much, but damn, oil does.
Yeah, what about gold? Do we see it staying at 1,000 plus, or is, you know, this is just a, no. is a commodity bubble here, or is this simply a flight to safety?
It's all of that, but it's more, gold has always been more of an inflation hedge. It is part of the commodity bubble. And when we go into a deflationary mode as opposed to inflation, after this decade, gold will go down.
Okay, David, last word?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're going to start seeing some of this come out, but it'll be over a couple of years. I don't see gold going anywhere just yet, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I think that this is a continuation of what's going to happen for our next, I don't know, at least a few months or something to that effect. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, gold should be higher for the next couple of years.
Like I said, I feel a lot better. And gentlemen, thanks for coming on. I got David Yaffin from Wall Street Journal, who writes The Market Beat. And I would suggest that you take a look at that, because he has some really great and timely. I mean, David, just to let you know, I love your stuff. Right on.
Thanks,
and Harry Dent, the author of several books and all about the bubble, the great bubble boom, all those. I'll put them on my website, and we'll get them. Harry, as always, thank you for joining us on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate
Thanks
it. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Coming up, the Zach Zone. New issues and IPOs. Ripe, ready, and researched. The Zach Zone.
All right, so as promised, we are going to talk about IPOs and new issues with my good friend Zach Scheidt, who is a portfolio manager extraordinaire. He has an expertise in the area of IPOs. And Zach, let's start at the beginning. Tell me, you know, for those of us who are really not schooled in this area, you know, explain what an IPO is, a new issue, and how it works.
Okay. Well, Andrew, to start with, there's basically companies that need to come to market to raise capital, whether it be that the actual company, maybe it's a biotech stock or biotech company that needs to raise capital to do their trials, or maybe it's somebody who needs to build a factory, or it might be a well-established company that has private investors that have already basically built this company. But at any rate, what they want to do is they want to raise capital by going to the market and selling this stock to individual investors, mutual funds, so forth. And whoever is selling the stock, whether it be the individual company or the private investors, get to basically collect on their investment. They get to sell the stock to the market and collect the money for the stock.
Okay, so now you have these private investors or these companies that are looking for investors, and they may have actually gone through a whole private funding process already, and they may have actually gone through a couple rounds of that, and now they come into the public saying, hey, you know what, we have a pretty good product here, pretty good company, and it looks like it's a great opportunity. We're going to sell you some of the shares. I mean, is that a summary? Okay.
It's basically like getting to the major leagues. You've been through the minor leagues. Right. You've gotten it. Finally, it's big enough that you can approach the big deal, the overall market.
Right. Okay. So now, this is not, I mean, when you think about it, it's not a new company. It's a company that has been around for a while because they have books and records and they have earnings histories and they have whatever else is going on with these guys, right?
Right. You can't bring a new company to the market because nobody wants to buy it. It's way too much risk. That's where the private investors make their money. Taking the risk on a small company, and then they cash in when they bring it to the market.
Right, that's the venture capitalists. Right. So we have venture capitalists that are going to be the first guys in. Then we have the next step, which is now the IPOs, the initial public offerings.
That's right.
Okay,
that's
perfect. Right. All right.
And so when these stocks do come to market, they've got to come to somebody. Somebody's got to buy them. And nobody knows about these stocks yet. So what happens is that the underwriters play a crucial role here. Now, the underwriters are people that you would recognize the names. Bear Stearns, which everybody recognizes after today.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley, Wachovia. I could go on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
And I deal with these guys on a day-to-day basis. But basically, these guys help find the buyers for the IPO shares.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got a book of business, basically. It may be mom and pops who have accounts, retirement accounts with Merrill Lynch and so forth, or it may be the big Fidelity mutual funds who are begging for shares of these deals as they come through.
So those guys are called the underwriters, right? So you have underwriters and these underwriter groups, and they call them, I think, syndications and syndicates, all these different players that are out there that are actually have these shares and now going to, I mean, for lack of a better word, peddle them to their customers.
Exactly, yeah. They've got all kinds of sexy names, but they're basically just salesmen. They've got to get the stock out. And they make a buku of money selling these stocks. So what happens is, say a company offers stock to the public at $34, the underwriters will usually take down maybe $2 of that $34 per share as their payment for selling the stock to their clients. Mm. So it's a very profitable business for the underwriters.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay, there's additional payments to the brokerages that sell it. I mean, there's a whole layer of cost. I mean, not to mention the legal fees and the administration and the filing fees and all that. But all right, so here we are. You know, all of a sudden this pie has been cut up. We got a company that has owners. Now they have venture capitalists in it. Now they have all the money that's being cut up from there. And now they have the IPO. And now it's out to the public. Now, the IPO comes out. It's pretty exciting. Oftentimes you hear there's an IPO coming out next week. What now happens? So it gets to the market. It's priced at, let's say, $25 per share. A certain amount of shares are released. And all of a sudden, it hits the market at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and it either stays put, moves really nicely, or it just flops.
But, that's right.
You know, so what I've always found interesting about IPOs is the pricing, because, you know, you find an IPO that what they call is oversubscribed. Oftentimes, there's more people that want to buy it than there are actually shares available. So what happens is when you first have the shares, let's say they're $15, and now when the final pricing comes up, which is a basic supply-demand scenario, they have now they're up to $18 a share, let's say, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they hit the market. And the market, and it goes up to $25 that day.
Now, well, like you said, it's a supply-demand issue.
So why didn't the underwriters figure that out beforehand and capture all that money instead of leaving it on the table?
Okay, well, it's a tough job to be an underwriter in the sense that you do have to do your due diligence on the company. You have to figure out where you think it's going to trade and where you think you can sell it. And so a typical best way for the underwriter to price this thing is, let's say that they come out and they price it at $18 and it starts trading at $20. That's about perfect for an underwriter, because it means that you got the best price that you could for the sellers. And it also means that you got a good price for your buyers, because they made a couple bucks on the trade.
Mm-hmm.
And so that way you'll be able to come around to them next time. You know, next time you've got another company to sell and you're peddling stock again, And you'll say, hey, that last one, you know, it was up $2 the first day. We can get you another one. So they really want it to pop a little bit. They always price these things where they hope that it will trade well from the offering.
All right, however, so give it a little bump. Yeah. I hear you. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you get one that doubles, then the sellers of the stock have got to be piping mad. I mean, after all, let's say that you come to the underwriter and you say, hey, I want to get some money for this company that I own. Let's sell it on the market. And he says, yeah, I think I can raise, you know, $50 million for you. And you sell it, and next thing you know, the stock that you just sold is worth $100 million. Mm. You go to the underwriter and you say, what the heck?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah, but the underwriter says, well, we just priced it wrong. Let's move on, and hopefully we'll get it back on the secondary.
I don't have another company to sell for $50 million.
Right, exactly. So, you know, I know there's different rules, and I guess they vary from brokerage house to brokerage house, but is there a holding period that's required usually on an IPO? You know, I know that a lot of times when we get IPOs for our clients, maybe, you know, a 60-day holding period till you can actually sell it. Is that what's the standard?
There's a standard. There's not a rule. So here's what happens. I have an account with Merrill Lynch, let's say. I go to Merrill Lynch and I say, hey, I'm really interested in this Google deal. And they say, okay, well, we'll figure it out and we'll help you get a few shares. So I end up pulling down 300 shares of Google. And it does really well and I immediately sell it. Well, what the underwriter does is they realize, okay, this guy is a flipper. And they label their clients as a flipper. If you do not stick with the stock and you immediately sell it out, then you're not the kind of person that they want to do business with.
Well, let's understand that, because the fact of the matter is, why? Well, because you're not helping to support the value of the stock for the guys that are making all the money on the value of the stock. Let's be honest.
That's right. I mean, the underwriters need this deal to do well. If it doesn't do well, it looks very poor on the underwriters, and they will have a hard time getting business the next time it comes around. So whenever they price a stock, they want it to trade up, and anybody who sells that stock causes pressure on the stock and is likely to cause the price to go down.
But meanwhile,
they want to sell to people who are going to hold it.
Yeah, but meanwhile, on the other side of the equation, there are shares by maybe the underwriters, et cetera, that may be cashing out a little bit on the money they made on the deal, right?
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, the underwriters may actually own it. Yeah, it's a political game.
Let me just restate the fact here, okay? And let me just make sure I get this straight. So, I'm required to hold the deal for 60 days because they don't want the stock price going down, and if it does, you know, they may put a little slap on the hand and say, "You know what? You're not going to be able to deal with the next two or three that come out." But in the meantime, the reason they want me to hold it is because, not for my own health, but because behind the scenes, they're selling it potentially, and they want to make sure that stock stays up while they're selling into it.
You're right. But Andrew, you phrased it wrong. You're not required to hold it. We're encouraging you to hold it.
Right.
So there's actually, they're not allowed to say you're not allowed to sell it.
Right. Yeah, I have an offer you can't refuse.
But let's just, you know, you and I will wink, wink, nudge, nudge. If you sell this thing, it will not go well for you in the future.
Yeah, I understand.
That's the way it works.
Well, I'm so happy that the average retail investor gets a fair shake in the deal. It makes me feel real good. Exactly. So what else is new? All right, so let's go into this discussion. Mr. Zach from, by the way, if anybody wants to check out Zach's site, Zach Stocks does a great job. ZachStocks.com, a wonderful job at analyzing stocks and, you know, really giving you a very good overview of a stock itself and the markets. Coming up, Visa.
Yes, sir.
Right now, it's it's at least slated to be, right now, as we sit here, if it actually comes out, the largest IPO in history in terms of dollar volume, right?
That's right.
And the only competition they have in this market, I guess, American Express in a way, but really that's a much more diluted type of operation, is MasterCard.
That's right.
And MasterCard is, you know, it's been all over the place of late. So tell us about Visa. Why is it so exciting? Why is it a bomb? Why is it terrific? You know, tell us about what's going on with this particular IPO.
Okay, well, to start with, Visa, like you said, is going to be a record breaker. It's going to be a $16 billion. That's billion with a B. That they're going to raise for the company, and basically for the investors of the company. Not only is it the largest, but it's actually coming at a really difficult time. So it'll be interesting to see whether the underwriters will be able to price this thing right. Now, we're actually facing a pretty interesting time in the market, because no IPOs or very few IPOs have been able to price over the last 4 months. November, the market was horrible. And when the market's horrible, it's not a good time to bring IPOs. December was quiet, just because it always is, because of the holidays. It's just difficult to get those deals priced during the holiday period. January, the market was horrible again. In February, it was bad. It wasn't horrible. So now we're going from horrible to bad, and bad is obviously better than horrible. And so now they're trying to come to the market with these.
Ah, I got you.
Okay, so it gets horrible again.
So they're gonna, yeah, right. But the problem is a double whammy for them, really, because they may not be, but they're perceived to be in the credit arena. But truth be known, they're much more of a processing firm and dealing with just the administration and processing of billing rather than issuing credit. But there's a little bit of a misunderstanding about that, I think, out there with the public, at least.
There is, and I'm sort of sick of hearing about it, honestly, because people, the analysts have been trying to hammer this home, and nobody's gotten the picture. But MasterCard, for instance, and Visa in the same way, doesn't take the risk of whether the credit cards will be paid back or not. So you and I go out and we buy a new stereo, we buy a new car, whatever it is, and we run up, you know, thousands of dollars worth of debt on these credit cards. Well, Visa and MasterCard don't really care whether we pay it back or not, because they're actual banks behind that are bearing the risk there. Visa and MasterCard just get a payment every time we make a transaction.
But let me throw this out to you, because I've heard this discussion, and I agree with you, by the way, but here's my take on that as well. The fact is that if you have a recessionary or whatever you want to call this economy that we have now, and if nothing else, people are fearful and shell-shocked about what's going on, and they're not spending as much, it doesn't hurt the credit at all, and they don't have the risk, but they won't be using their credit potentially as much. They won't be using their credit cards as much. And that could be to the detriment of these companies.
And that's why I'm sick of these analysts pounding the table for MasterCard and Visa and saying that they're great because they have no credit exposure. Mm-hmm. They may not have credit exposure, but they have huge consumer exposure.
Right.
See, because all it takes is, well, you get the solicitations in the mail, don't you? Open a Visa and you get a new iPod or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Well, people are getting these over and over and over. But guess what? Now, more than ever, as people go ahead and apply for their 15th Visa or MasterCard credit card, they're getting denied because their credit's already in shambles. They've already run up debts on every other card that they own. So what happens when you can't open a new credit card and all of your other credit cards are maxed out? Is your transaction volume going to continue to climb?
Yeah, no, obviously it's a problem, huge problem. And then I'll talk to you about something else that's a little bit kind of maybe not here yet, but something that I do believe is going to happen, that they're going to have to change up from the traditional credit card processing, which they do, but really go much more online and we'll call it device-enabled payment systems, like the GPay system, which Google is working on, for example. I think that what we really need to be looking at is next-generation payment processing, like when you use your phone with maybe biotechnology. Let me give you a quick picture. iPhone. iPhone is big enough to have a bio reader, if you will, for your thumbprint, and use that with a IR infrared device where you can wave it over your groceries, and then it comes up and it says, please identify, and you put your thumb on the print area, and it confirms your identification, and that goes through your banking. That they can make money on if they actually get into that market, which they will. But I agree with you. The fact is that they are going to have to be very careful. So are the analysts. But remember something. Let's get back to the original point here. The fact is, there's a lot of money in IPOs, and why not just beef these up as best as possible and show its best side? Because in the end, the truth is, Zach, and I think that you believe this too, the retail investor is always going to be the one that takes the crap and loses, and the institutional guys are going to do their very best to make sure that they come out, you know, with the top dollar.
Yes, you're right. You're right. And the difficulty is Visa will be a great deal. They will price it right because they have to. They've got to get $16 million or billion dollars worth of inventory priced. But the problem is very few retail investors will actually get shares of Visa.
Yeah.
I'll get some, and I'm working for a $100 million hedge fund, and I will have a difficult time bringing in as many shares as I'd like to.
Yeah, I know. We've done this before. We go out and we try to get, we put in our order, okay, we're going to take 10,000 shares. And at the end of the day, we get, 622. I'm like,
And you're supposed to be thankful for it.
Yeah, what am I doing with that?
Oh, we got you.
We got you
600.
Right, great. Exactly. Yep. Holding on to it for hell of high water. So can I ask you a question? I want to skip over to another IPO that you may be knowledgeable about, but something's been really bugging me.
Okay.
There's a company called Orbitz, which is a travel related online slash airplane and hotel booking company. And Orbitz was around and had an IPO some time ago, a number of years ago. And the company really, they did really lousy. I mean, really lousy to a point they almost went under. And then lo and behold, one day they reemerge and they do another IPO.
Right.
And the stock has once again gone straight downhill.
Yeah, they. I believe they priced the IPO at 15. That was back in July of last year.
Why do they think? Honestly, I'm not kidding about this. Do they think? And I guess they do. Do they think they're just totally going to rip us off?
Well, they did.
I guess I didn't buy it, but I hear you. No, but seriously, I mean, how do they get away with that kind of? I mean, here's the point. I guess here's the point. Here's the question. So I'm an average guy, and I see this Orbitz coming out, and I'm thinking, hey, that's a pretty good deal, right? Huh? I don't know any background. Where do I check it? Where do I find information? Where do I go?
Well, I mean, you can always go. All the prospectuses and so forth are public information. So if you're willing to do your own digging, you go in, you look at the prospectus, and you see how much money the company's earning. Then you go online, and you look at comparables. I mean, you can look on Yahoo Finance, Google Finance, and figure out who else is in the travel services business, and you know what kind of multiples are they trading at, and what are the revenue trends, and so forth.
But where do you go? There's an IPO Central. There's I think there's IPO.com. Hoover's has something. I mean, where do you go? Where's the place that you go for the average?
All three of those are actually good sources, and there's one more that I'd add to it, and it's MorningNotes.com. Not to be confused with Morningstar.
Right, MorningNotes.
But Ben Holmes, he and I have actually been friends for quite some time. And he keeps track of the IPOs and the secondaries that are priced on a regular basis. And he just has a great site that does an overview of all the different IPOs that are coming through, and then and links to all the research that you can pull
up. That's good. All right, because it is a little bit of a it's not as transparent as I would like it to be. You know, I just think there's that extra bit of kind of layer of. Obfuscation. What am I looking for? Cloudiness. Cloudiness.
Well, let me tell you how you really need to find out. Here's what you do: is you set up an account with Merrill Lynch, you set up an account with Wachovia, you set up an account with Bear Stearns, you set up an account with Goldman Sachs, and you put $3 or $4 million with each one of these guys.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you can do that, then you won't have any trouble figuring out what deal is hot and what deal is not, because you're clued into all of these different brokers. The problem is that Most individual investors don't have $3 million to put with each one of these brokers.
Right.
And
the average guy's not going to get the deal. Yeah, you know, you have to have, there has to be somebody, you know, that you're friends with or something like that. And it's a very, there's a huge inequity in this, and it's very unfair. But it is what it is. But the truth is that we also know there have been times and ranges of dates that are extremely exciting for IPOs. But the market, I'd like to see how this Visa deal is going to price, because with the lack of credit, with the inability of individuals to really reach into their pocket and put another dime into the market, with what's going on and everything else out there, I'd be really surprised if this is going to be such, it'll be hot, but it won't be, as oversubscribed as it would be in a good market condition, obviously.
Well, that's true. Or maybe they just won't be able to get as much money for it as they would. Maybe, now they're going to price it at, 37 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But if it was a good market, they might be able to get 47 or 50 or 67 for it.
All right, what we're going to do is put all links to Zach's stocks on our website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and also we'll have the links to the various places where you can find out about IPOs. And we're going to have a new segment starting in the next week or so that Zach is going to come and give us IPO information and some things to look at in the IPO market, as well as all the things you need to know about new issues, etc. So, Zach from Zach Stocks, I appreciate you being here on the Disciplined Investor Show, and let's make some money, my friend.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Andrew.
Additional information and research on the stocks mentioned can be found at thedisciplinedinvestor.com.
That wraps it up for this week. Next week, we have some great guests coming up, so stick around for that. Thank you for joining me again. Don't forget, March 20th, my birthday, we're going to have a debate with Tim Sykes, Blog Talk Radio, and Zecco. Go to the site, thedisciplinedinvestor.com. There's plenty of information there, and you could register. It's free. And ask your questions and get on the air. It's kind of like a live radio show. And then on top of that, if you would do me a favor, like I asked you, I'll beg you one more time, take a look over at Amazon.com for my book, The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success. Thanks for listening to The Disciplined Investor, episode 48. Stay around because Mike Huckman is going to be analyzing some biotechs and healthcares next week on The Disciplined Investor podcast, episode number 49. He's a CNBC special correspondent. Be well, be safe, be careful. It's rough out there. Go to the blog, check it out, because I'm going to give you some good advice on how to make some money this week. Speak to you real soon. This is Andrew Horowitz, over and out.
The Disciplined Investor podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.